Well, hello, and welcome to this week's Talking History. This is Brian Laveau, Chairman of the Department of History at Creighton University, and I will be your host. We have four items in this week's History in the News, all of which deal with historic monuments: longstanding, recently dedicated, in the planning stages, and just proposed. First, one of the nation's most famous monuments, a memorial to a Civil War regiment of black soldiers created by sculptor Augustus St. Gaudens a century ago, is itself being honored by having its original plaster form exhibited at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. The actual bronze monument stands on Boston Commons, and it has become even more popular among Civil War buffs and even the general public since the movie Glory made famous those it honors, the 54th Massachusetts Regiment and its leader, Colonel Robert Gould Shaw. Recently dedicated in Washington, D.C. is the FDR Memorial in honor of the president who helped lead the nation through two of its greatest trials, the Great Depression and World War II. Franklin Roosevelt once said he wanted a simple monument about the size of his desk. What he got sprawls across 7.5 acres, cost $48 million, features waterfalls, bronze statues, and enough granite to construct an 80-story building, and places him in the company of only three other American presidents with national memorials in the Capitol: George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. Ordered back to the drawing board was the proposed World War II monument to be erected on the National Mall, not because of any lack of enthusiasm for the project, but because of the large number of objections to its design and location. Critics argue that the monument, as proposed, is inappropriate and environmentally insensitive in that it would require removal of the historic Rainbow Pool and the uprooting of several mature trees. And finally, proposed for the future is a monument to the Korean War veterans. Kenneth Cook, a Korean War vet, and the National Korean War Veterans Organization is leading this charge, but with an unusual twist. They want it to be in Tuscola, Illinois. Cook, who lives in nearby Danville, and his supporters list among the virtues of Tuscola, and as opposed to those of Washington, that it is located near the center of the country and where there is greater support for their efforts. So take that, Washingtonians. Organizers hope to have the monument completed by the year 2000, the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the Korean War. And turning to this week in history, our diligent researchers of the historical record would remind you that on October 13, 1792, the first stones for the White House were laid, the official home of the President of the United States. On October 14, 1947, U.S. Air Force Captain Charles, or Chuck Yeager, became the first man to break the sound barrier when he reached supersonic speeds while testing the XS-1 out of the Merrick Air Force Base in California. On October 16, 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis, which brought the U.S. and the Soviet Union to the brink of war, began after President Kennedy received information that the Soviets had installed missiles in Cuba. On October 18, 1767, the Mason-Dixon Line, which established the border between Maryland and Pennsylvania, was drawn. In time, the Mason-Dixon Line, of course, divided the northern and southern United States on the issue of slavery. And on October 19, 1765, the Stamp Act Congress met in New York City to discuss grievances concerning English rule of the American colonies. Representatives voiced frustration with what they claimed was taxation without representation. Well, you don't need me to remind you, as we move more deeply into the fall season, that another summer has come and gone, and all our vacations are rapidly fading from memory as we hunker down for another winter. What better time to discuss public amusements and the prospect that they may, in fact, be fading away as well? With us today to discuss the history of public amusements is David Nassau, Executive Officer of the History Program at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Professor Nassau is the author of Going Out, The Rise and Fall of Public Amusements, published by Basic Books. Going Out is a delightful and entertaining book, but it's also quite serious. It's part cultural history, to be sure, especially popular culture, but it is also good social history. It places popular cultural developments during what many would argue is the great age of public amusements in the context of developments and changes in American society out of which these forms of public amusement first appeared, flourished, and then declined. Welcome, Professor Nassau. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Okay. Let me start again with some basic questions, some obvious ones. When you write or speak of public amusements, just what do you mean? What kind of amusements do you include?
Well, in my book, and when I talk about public amusements, I'm talking about the entertainment forms and sites that were developed in the early part of this century. I'm talking about amusements that attract a large and diverse population of Americans and that reach across lines of class, education, social background, neighborhood, to draw as great a cross-section of the American public as possible.
Okay, so it's that public nature then that differentiated from other forms of amusements where individuals might be involved in their own home or elsewhere.
Yeah, what I was fascinated in, and this is how this book really began, what I was fascinated with was the simultaneity of the development of different institutions. When you look back at the turn of the century, the early years of the 20th century, you see all at once the baseball stadia are built to cater to tens of thousands of Americans. And with the base at the same exact time, there are the World's Fairs, there are amusement parks, there are vaudeville palaces, there's the beginning of the movies in the Nickelodeons and then in the movie theaters and the movie palaces. And what all of these have in common is that they attract, again, a large cross-section of Americans. They attract more of them than ever before. And the prices are set so low that they can attract working people who had previously been shut out of leisure time activities.
Okay. Let me just back up and bracket that if I could. So you're talking about a period of time here, what we might call the sort of the great age of public amusements, I think is one phrase you use. And when did that exactly begin?
It begins slowly with the birth of vaudeville in the 1890s and really extends through the 1920s.
Okay. And why did it start then? What brought it about?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I think a great many things bring it about. One of the things that brings it about is there is a steady decrease in work hours and an increase in income that allows working people who had previously worked from dusk to dawn 6 days a week to now get home a little earlier 5 days a week, have a half holiday on Saturday and make enough money so that they can indulge in entertainments that might have been beyond the reach of their ancestors, of their parents. More importantly, or as importantly, there is a new breed of entrepreneurs, beginning with the vaudeville entrepreneurs. Some of them come out of circus backgrounds, some of them come out of theater backgrounds. Some of them are entirely new to the business, but they understand a absolutely critical fact, and that is that if you bring down the price of a ticket, you can increase the audience to the point where you more than make up for the loss in the price of each ticket. And it is vaudeville and the vaudeville impresarios who are the first to realize this truth, and they are followed by a whole group of entrepreneurs and impresarios who create a new wave of entertainment.
Okay. Now, you've suggested here something that don't want to put words in your mouth, but are we talking about a very democratic form of amusement then?
Well, when I began to my research, I was struck by that. I was struck by it immediately. It is, and the entrepreneurs and the commentators and the newspaper journalists were immediately struck by how democratized the new audience was for vaudeville, for the amusement parks, for the world's fairs. It was a brand new phenomenon in American life, mm-hmm. because the prices were low enough that everybody could come, and the entertainment was, quote, respectable enough so that everyone would want to come. The vaudeville impresarios were the first, again, to understand that if you moved the bar out of the theater, and if you moved away the spittoons, and if you cleaned up the entertainment a little bit, you could attract women. And once you attracted women, you would attract even more men with them. And that nighttime entertainments could be not only for the rowdy and the risque, but could be for the broader population as well.
Were there, for example, excluded groups like blacks?
Well, this was the next discovery that I made. When I first began this research, I was taken by the democratization of the audience and taken by the ways in which these new entertainment forms cut across previous social boundaries of class and of gender and of ethnicity to involve a much greater proportion of the American public than ever before, rich and poor, native and immigrant, men and women. But as I did my research, I discovered that one group was very, very, very conspicuously missing from the World's Fairs, from the amusement parks, from the vaudeville theaters and the movie theaters, and that was African Americans.
Were they excluded from both sides of the aisle, so to speak, both from the entertained and the entertainers?
No. What was even more interesting to me was that while African Americans were excluded from these entertainment sites or segregated in the upper balconies of some of the theaters, they were almost omnipresent on the screen or as part of the show. It was impossible to escape some caricature of African Americans in vaudeville, at the amusement parks, in early film. And the discrepancy between their absence in the audience and their omnipresence on the stage led me to think that this was not coincidental. That in fact what was going on was that these new entertainment sites were helping to develop a new definition of what it meant to be American, what it meant to be civilized, what it meant to be respectable and middle class. And that definition was one with a new definition of whiteness. That as the American public was being brought together, it was being defined as a white American public, in contradistinction to African Americans who were said to be and stigmatized as uncivilized and therefore not fit to be part of this much larger audience.
Interesting point. Okay. Well, your book has many examples, and I wish we had enough time to go through all of them, amusement parks, world fairs, baseball, and so on. We only have sort of a minute for one example here, but let's take vaudeville. Everyone's heard of it, but probably not many people really understand what it was about. Can you give me sort of a very brief thumbnail sketch of how that evolved in this time period?
Vaudeville is a spectacular kind of entertainment. I wish it were still with us. What was most characteristic of vaudeville was that it was a potpourri, a wild mixture of different kinds of entertainments. It was intentionally put together to appeal to every segment of the population. There were acrobats and clowns for the kids. There were opera singers for the middle-class ladies. There were concert violinists. There were rough-and-tumble comedy troupes. There were animal acts. There were tap dancers and jugglers and comedians. There was something for everyone.
Yeah.
Towards the second decade of vaudeville, they even began bringing in stars of the stage, like the Barrymores, to perform 10-minute scenes from their recent plays, to bring in Shakespearean actors to do soliloquies. The key to vaudeville was to make it as broadly appealing as possible, and to make it possible for the largest audience to go. Vaudeville show of 12 acts would be continuous. It would repeat over and over again. So there was no starting time, no ending time. You could come in at any time during the show and simply stay until you had seen all the acts.
Great.
And that made it much easier for working people to go after work, for kids to go, for housewives to take in a matinee.
That must have been interesting. I would have liked to have experienced one of them. Well, certainly the most controversial part of your book is that you talk about the decline of public amusements. Well, what happened? What brought it? First of all, tell me what you mean by decline and tell me why it fell apart.
Well, just as all of these institutions come together at the same time, they all seem to disappear at the same time. The baseball parks, the movie palaces, the amusement parks, all go into a decline that they don't come out of in the 40s and in the 50s. And although much of it has to do with television, not all of it has to do with television. There is, in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, there is a widespread anxiety that is new to the 20th century city about danger, about crime, about the prevalence of criminality, and that it's part and parcel of the urban experience. Now, you know, the cities have always been places of crime and of danger, but there was a sense, I think, that this was under control until the immediate post-war period. And I think a lot of it had to do with the new populations in the city. A lot of it had to do with the movement north of African Americans and the remaking of the boundaries of the city.
So it tracks the decline of the inner city, essentially, is what you're saying.
I think so. And I think it also leads to the decline of the inner city.
And the rise of the suburbs?
As fewer and fewer people come into the cities to see entertainment, as the city loses its amusement parks and its movie theaters, there's less of an attraction, and more people are willing to move out to the suburbs.
So it's tracking a problem then also for American society, or are we just simply shifting to another form of entertainment that tracks sort of the demographics of late 20th, early 21st century America?
I think it's all of those things. I really do. But I think that at the same time, my book describes the rise and fall of these public amusements. If I were to rewrite it, or if I were to extend it, I think, into the late 20th century, in the beginning of the 21st century, I think I'd talk about a rise again. Because I think the cities and the people in the cities and the American people have understood what's been lost and are attempting to rebuild the center cities as places of entertainment.
Oh.
A large number of cities now have moved their ballparks, as began in Baltimore, back into the center of the city now. Are beginning to set up festival marketplaces to remake amusement areas in the center of the city, to bring back the kinds of excitement, the diversity.
Oh, good. Maybe we can get that in the next edition of your book. It's nice to end on a positive note. So, well, okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time for this segment of Talking History, but I'd like to thank you, Professor Nassau, for being with us today, and congratulations on the success of your book.
Thank you so much.
I hope you'll join us again soon. Once again, Professor David Nassau is the author of Going Out, The Rise and Fall of Public Amusements, published by Basic Books. We'll be back in a moment. In the concluding segment of our show this week, in keeping with our theme of amusements, I'd like to recommend to you two recently published pieces on perhaps the most popular magazine of the 1940s and 50s, Life magazine. The first, a book appropriately loaded with wonderful pictures, is Life's America, Family and Nation in Postwar Photojournalism by Wendy Kuzel, published by Temple University Press. The second is an article which appeared in the winter 96 issue of The Journal of American Culture, available, I'm sure, at your local public library, written by Richard Martin, and it is titled Style from Paris, Reality from America, Fashion in Life magazine, 1947-1963. As their title suggests, Kuzel examines life's representation of the American family, while Martin looks at how the magazine pictured clothing fashions. Nostalgic films and television shows notwithstanding, the late 40s and 50s were years of considerable conflict. Cold War, civil rights protests, other threats to international and domestic peace. Nevertheless, Wendy Kuzel finds that Life helped shape a reassuring portrait of America for its readers by depicting in its pages the ideal family, which happened to be white, suburban, and middle class. In one representative story, for example, the cover photo shows an unfinished home in which a kneeling woman embraces two blonde little girls and a man in a business suit protectively holds a toddler. The caption reads, "Family buys, quote, best $15,000 house." The cost of the house suggests, of course, that this is a middle-class family with a bright future, and the celebratory picture as a whole reveals no hint of the political and economic instability of the period. Kuzel finds the magazine, as a rule, represented the American family in this way, thereby normalizing the affluent nuclear family and supporting middle-class consumption by defining the family as much by their possessions as by their conformity to traditional roles. In sum, she suggests, Life put into pictures the post-war American dream, helping to create a nationally shared ideal while minimizing the glaring differences outside its pages of race and class. And turning to Richard Martin, he reminds us that pictures representing the latest fashions were also frequent and an important part of Life magazine. In those years, Martin writes, Life helped form a new epoch of fashion, one in which the authority of the Paris fashion continued to reign supreme, but then American designers posed their first serious challenge, especially in the area of casual attire. By way of evidence, Martin points to the famous 1946 photograph of Barbara Hutton wearing good old American culottes, being barred from the front entrance of the Hotel Ritz, despite the fact that she was one of the richest women in the world. In this picture, and in many others, Life is clearly on the side of the American and modern woman. Probably the most entertaining part of Martin's essay, however, deals with a lead article for the September 26, 1960 issue of Life, titled The Fancy Fashion Fuss. The article takes on the fashion flap created by the 1960 presidential campaign, not by John Kennedy and Richard Nixon, but by Mrs. Kennedy and Mrs. Nixon. The article reads, and I'm quoting now, Jackie Kennedy speaks, "I'm sure I spend less than Mrs. Nixon on clothes. She gets hers at Elizabeth Arden." Pat Nixon responds, "I buy most of my clothes off the racks of different stores around Washington." Jackie, denying reports that she and her mother-in-law spend $30,000 a year on Paris clothes, responds, "I couldn't spend that much unless I wore sable underwear." To which Pat responds, "I like American designers. I think they are the best in the world." And so it was. Once again, we've been discussing Life's America by Wendy Kuzel, published by Temple University Press, and Style from Paris, Reality from America, Fashion and Life magazine, 1947 to 1963, which appeared in the winter 96 issue of the Journal of American Culture. And that brings us to the end of another Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments to offer, questions to raise, topics to suggest for future programs, send them to us either by email at talkinghistory, all one word, at creighton.edu, or by regular mail at Talking History, two words, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian LeBeau, closing the show with another piece of music in keeping with our theme today, Scott Joplin's The Cascades, inspired by the spectacular water display at the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair.